Well, the first panel is coming up. Let me briefly introduce them. First of all, we have Dean Baker from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, Douglas Holtz Eakin from the American Action Forum, Rudy Penner from Urban Institute, and Belle Sawhill from Brookings, and we've asked Bruce to join the panel as well. Each of the folks who haven't spoken yet will have 7 minutes to make an opening statement and reflect in any way they please on the President's plan or any of the other plans or the general problem of how we're going to solve the deficit or at least make good progress on the deficit. And we have also asked each of the panelists to make at least one comment about whether programs for the poor and opportunity should be protected. So let's begin with Dean Baker.
Okay, well, I guess I'm going to be somewhat of an outlier here because I'm going to say that I don't think the deficit is a really big problem. I realize I'm an outlier with that, but let me just point out, had I been here 3 years ago, I would have been jumping up and down yelling about the huge housing bubble that's about to collapse and going to wreck the economy. And I also would have been an outlier then, too. I'll point out I was not invited here 3 years ago. But, well, let me just say, you know, just starting with the basic question, should the poor, should the most disadvantaged be protected? To my mind, this is kind of like, how could we think otherwise? We're getting richer as a country. We're not getting poorer. I just, out of curiosity, I was looking back because of this panel at the projections from 1995. That was before the productivity speed up, and at that time we also had people running around concerned about the deficit and the end of the world and all that. And I just said, suppose we did the good thing, because the Congressional Budget Office makes projections. Suppose we did the right thing, balanced the budget, what would things look like? Well, just out of curiosity, I ran this through, and guess what? In 2010, per capita income in the United States, even with the Great Recession, is higher than what the Congressional Budget Office projected for 2020 if we had balanced the budget each and every year between 1995 and 2020. Of course, we haven't done that. My point is just we're getting richer. This idea that, you know, 10, 20, 30 years out, our children are going to be living in poverty, there is no real story about that. So that, at the onset, I think is seriously misleading. Now, will we protect the poor? I'm not terribly confident. I recognize, you know, the commission did a lot of good work, and I recognize their intentions, but there's some things that lead me just great grounds for concern, and I'll mention a couple things in particular. First off, the cost of living adjustment for Social Security. This is treated as this trivial issue that we're going to reduce the annual cost of living adjustment. We'll change the indicator. We could talk about the accuracy of that, another question. But we're going to change the index of inflation that will lower the cost of living adjustment by about 0.3% a year. Now, for someone who's on getting benefits for 20 years, that's an average reduction over that period of roughly 3%. Is that a big deal? Well, we're led to believe it's not. Well, how much will the loss in income for the average person in the top 2% if the Bush tax cuts expired? Well, it'd be less than that. A lot of people down on Capitol Hill think that's a really big deal. So if it's a big deal that people in that top 2% might pay somewhat higher taxes, we should also think that change in the cost of living adjustment for Social Security beneficiaries is a big deal. The second cause of concern I would raise is simply the magic asterisk. How do we control health care costs? Well, as we know, and I'll come back to this in a second, the big issue going out in terms of the budget, of course, is health care costs. Was the commission say, well, we're going to get them below 1%. We're going to limit the rate of increase in health care costs. Well, how is that going to be done? No one really knows. So we could certainly do that in ways, in principle, that won't hurt the most vulnerable. Are we confident that's going to happen? I'd just say I'd be skeptical. I mean, let's hope for the best, but I'd be skeptical. One more thing in terms of, you know, the honesty and how we talk about this. I've been kind of appalled that there's been an effort, at least I would say, to appeal to xenophobia in terms of making the case about the deficit in talking about borrowing from China. Whether we think borrowing from China is a good or bad thing, that's an issue about the trade deficit, not the budget deficit. Okay, if we're running a $300 billion a year trade deficit with China, China's sitting there with $300 billion that they could use to buy any asset they like in the United States. If they want, they could buy shares of GM stock, they could buy bonds, they could buy U.S. government bonds, whether or not we're running a deficit. We have a balanced budget. We've got trillions of dollars of debt out there. So we're good boys and girls who run a balanced budget forevermore. We've got trillion dollars of debt out there. China, if it likes, could buy up $300 billion a year of government debt, even though we're running a balanced budget. So let's get China out of this debate. There are things we could talk about with China has nothing to do with the deficit. Okay, now, I'm saying the heretical thing that I don't consider the deficit a problem. Let me just quickly take short-term, mid-term, long-term. Short-term, we're in the middle of the Great Recession. We have 9.8% unemployment. Suppose we found the Department of Waste, Fraud, and Abuse, cut the trillion-dollar appropriation. You know, what would happen? What would be the, you know, we now have, you know, more or less balanced budget. Well, we'd have just cut $1 trillion in demand from the economy. There is no mechanism you could talk about today that's going to transfer that into new demand in the private sector. Ordinarily, I know the interest rate story. You can't tell that today. That will not work. There is no short-term deficit problem. Okay, midterm. Let's look out to 2020. I was looking at this. If you look at the CBO projections for the president's budget, we have a deficit of 5.6% of GDP. It's too big. Okay, suppose we say we had the same interest burden in 2020 as we did back in 2008, before the crisis. We would have a deficit of 3.3% GDP. Arguably too big, but not the sort of thing you'd run around like the world's falling 10 years ahead of time. Now, what's the difference there? Well, it's the interest burden on the debt. The Federal Reserve Board could buy and hold debt. We're actually doing that to some extent. The Federal Reserve Board refunded $77 billion to the government last year, almost $40 billion of net interest. Now, we may not do that. I know there's issues of inflation. I can explain how you can control that. But that's a policy decision. That's not a given. Now, the long term, we know we have deficits going through the roof. That's 100% health care. If our health per person health care costs were the same as in Germany, Canada, pick your country, we would be looking at huge budget surpluses, not huge deficits. Now, I know it's not easy to control health care costs, but let's be honest with people. We have a health care problem. It manifests itself in part as a deficit problem, but first and foremost, it's a problem of health care costs. If we don't control health care costs, it doesn't matter what we do with our public sector health care programs. We're going to have an enormous nightmare on our hand down the road. So let's be honest. I mean, I often make this analogy. Suppose we were projecting in 2029 that we'd have nuclear war. Now, if we looked at the budget projections for 2030 and beyond, it'd be horrible. Now, what person in their right mind would say, oh, my God, we have a huge long-term budget problem? But that's, in effect, what we've done. I know it's not easy to fix health care. You've got powerful interests, the doctors, the pharmaceutical industry, the health insurance industry. We did not accomplish nearly as much as what needed to be done in the health care reform that was passed earlier this year, but that's not an excuse for going away and just dropping the issue. It's sort of like if the schoolyard bully's beating you up every day, you go and find the weakest kid in the class and you punch him. It doesn't make any sense. We have to fix health care. If we had a realistic discussion here, we'd be focused on fixing health care costs. That, at the end of the day, is our long-term deficit problem. That's the problem that's going to face the country and determine whether our children face serious hardship or not. It's not a government that's out of control. It's health care costs are out of control. Thank you.
Douglas Holtz-Eakin.
Well, thank you, Ron, and thank you to the sponsors and for the chance to be here today, I think, because I've been talking about budget issues for way too long, and I'm really tired of hearing myself talk about it. It does seem like Groundhog Day. I said with great confidence in 2003, I remember it vividly, that the spending train was leaving the station, and they were just going to have one last drink before the party was over, and here we are again. So take all forecasts with a grain of salt, and you know, we'll see how the future plays out. But you know, my job here is basically to completely disagree with everything you just heard, and to congratulate Bruce and the commission for vastly exceeding expectations. I am among those cynics who had very, very low expectations for what would come out of the commission, and I believe that it accomplished some enormously important things. Number one, it provided a real lesson to the size of the problem and took, I think, conclusively off the table the fantasies that people have about fixing this with reduced foreign aid, improved administration, lower waste, fraud, and abuse, all of the pet hobby horses. I mean, this is an enormous problem, and it is a great threat to our nation. Literally, our prosperity and our freedoms are at stake, and so I think they're to be congratulated for that. They identified that the problem is spending, that their proposals target more spending than taxes because that's where the problem is, and that's an unmistakably important lesson for everyone to understand. I think the other big lesson they really did make clear is that everything has to be on the table, and that, of course, produces the tension that we're going to talk about here today. There is no way to leave defense off the table. There's no way to leave the non-defense discretionary off the table. The entitlement programs, all the mandatory spending has to be under consideration, and that juggling act, I think, is going to be central. Next big lesson, for me at least, was the route to higher revenues is through tax reform, and that is one of the lessons that has come out of many of these commissions, but I think was elucidated most powerfully by Bowles, Simpson, and their proposals. And that's something that I truly hope we get to see and see quickly in the U.S. And then the last lesson really comes back to Dean's point, and that is that healthcare has to be taken on. And I thought that was the negative lesson of the commission. They're a bit too gentle on the health programs, although merely the contemplation of the Ryan Rivlin Amendment, I thought, was an important step for reality, that we have to ultimately think about having budget constraints on health programs in the United States was a big step. So my congratulations for what they accomplished. Now, going forward, I think what has to happen is you have to breathe into this budgetary shell an animating vision about the future of America. It is one thing to make the numbers add up. It is another thing to say, this is the principles by which we will make the numbers add up and support the things that we value in the society. And that, I think, is the challenge that faces our leaders at this point. For me, crucial among those animating visions has to be an emphasis on pursuit of faster growth in the United States. We, in making all these budgetary choices, should at every juncture err on the side of the one that produces faster growth. We have millions and millions of Americans who are out of work. We have a threat to the prosperity of the next generations. We have a need for budgetary resources that will only come with an economy that's growing rapidly. And I think that the top principle should be the one that produces greater economic growth. Second principle should be the one that produces the greatest economic mobility, the restoring the capacity of people to move both up and down, as the case may be, through the income distribution in the United States. Those should be core principles by which we make these decisions. That produces real tensions, and I don't think we should kid ourselves about that. If you're going to err on the side of economic growth, that means that when you look at budgetary items, whether they're tax expenditures or outlay programs, you are going to move away from the ones that favor consumption and toward those that favor investments, toward those that lead to greater prosperity in the future. That is at odds with conventional politics, where handing out the goodies for more things now is par for the course. It is also a real threat to the poor and near poor, because if you are reducing programs oriented toward consumption, you are, in fact, putting those at risk. And so, for me, we have the following dilemma, which is it is a dangerous thing to create protected classes in budgetary times such as these. The poor and near poor could be a protected class. The very elderly would be a sensible protected class. College students might be a sensible protected class. Teachers, we love teachers, we'll make them a protected class. Small businessmen should be a protected class, sacred on the right. Farmers, heart of America, they should be protected. It's pretty soon we will have protected everybody. And the flip side to that is we cannot in any realistic fashion do this on the backs of the poor. So I leave you with no particular wisdom or insight, just the two nagging concerns that, number one, we will do this poorly and harm some people and not grow going in the future, or number two, that we just won't do it. We will decide that these various politically protected classes are so sacred that we will just continue to fiddle while the U.S. burns, and that would be the greatest injustice of all, because the fairness question here is not so much among those sitting in this room or alive at the moment. The fairness question is between this generation and the ones that follow us, and we are doing them a great injustice at the moment, and I think have an obligation to fix it.
Thank you. Rudy Penner.
Well, when Ronald Reagan was governor of California, he once said that my feet are in concrete against any tax increase. Then when he came to a press conference to announce that he was accepting a tax increase, he said, the sound you hear is concrete cracking. And I think that concrete is cracking all over Washington, but unfortunately it's not crumbling yet, and we have a long way to go before we can fix our fiscal problems. But one good thing that has happened is that the president's fiscal commission was successful beyond my wildest dreams. And it's been joined by an equally successful bipartisan commission, and a plethora of other commissions and committees have sprung up and offered a great variety of options for getting our fiscal house in order. And everyone now believes that they have to have a budget plan, whether they're on the right, left, or in the center. And even those who were earlier argued that we did not have a problem now have to come forth with options. I'll accept Dean from that requirement. The task before the President's Commission looked so hopeless that few of us had any hope that anything good would come of it. And the final report didn't get the 14 of 18 votes that its rules required, but it did get 11, and that was a significant achievement. And even more amazing, six of the supporting votes were from elected members, four of whom are very likely to run again. And even more surprising, as Bruce noted, the support ranged from Senator Coburn, who can claim to be the most conservative member of the Senate, to Senator Durbin, whose liberal credentials are not in question. And I think that Bruce deserves enormous credit for how he helped the commission come to this kind of result. But the great disappointment is that so far support from the president has been tepid. There was outright initial support from Speaker Pelosi, and not much enthusiasm can be found anywhere else in the country. So I haven't changed my bottom line, that it's probably going to take a fiscal crisis before we finally fix this problem. But as a result of the President's Commission and all the others, we now have this very rich menu of policy options to choose from when the crisis comes, as it inevitably must, unless we act. Well, what might these policy options do to the poor? I think that's the wrong way to look at it. The really important point here is that the whole intent of these various commissions and committees is to prevent the poor and the rich and everyone in between from suffering the severe pain that would be imposed if we sink into a Greek-like or Irish-like crisis. It's not really clear whether a crisis of that sort hurts the poor or the rich more as unemployment soars and the value of assets held by the rich collapses. But at that point, the main result is that everybody hurts a great deal. When fiscal consolidation comes, as it must, as a result of a crisis, middle-class social insurance programs tend to be cut, and usually it's hard to avoid cuts in welfare as well. In Greece, Ireland, and in Britain's fiscal consolidation, it may be the civil servants, actually, who end up hurting the most. They don't do so well in the President's Commission either. It appears that they're pretty unpopular all over the world. But I think it's fair to say that there's a greater risk of program cuts for the poor if fiscal reforms occur in response to a fiscal crisis as opposed to fiscal consolidation occurring as a result of a more deliberative process. And even if we don't have a crisis for a good long time, these huge deficits are going to absorb so much saving, they're going to slow our rate of economic growth, and again, all groups, including the poor, are likely to be worse off. It may not be all that productive to ask who's more worse off compared to where they might have been with more growth. And I do think the various committees did take pains to protect the poor. Radical tax reforms were offered, but everyone that I saw kept the EITC, they kept the child credit and other provisions for the poor. The Social Security reforms generally tried to be progressive. Tax increases mainly took the form of base increases. So-called progressive indexing was proposed by several groups, and the President's Commission took the added step of proposing a minimum benefit. I'm not actually sure that playing with Social Security benefits is the most effective way of redistributing income. The Social Security Administration thinks my wife is poor, but the Commission's heart was in the right place. Again, I return to the main point. The intent of these groups is to help everybody by avoiding a crisis and enhancing our prospects for economic growth. and the poor have much to gain from that compared to the alternatives.
Bell Sawhill.
Well, like Rudy and Doug, I give the commission high marks for having put forward a really bold and comprehensive plan. And Bruce Reed had a huge amount to do with that, and so my hat is off to Bruce. I think the principles that the commission followed were basically very sound principles. There was, you know, trying to get everything onto the table. The notion of shared sacrifice, to go back to Patrick's opening remarks, was there. And I think certainly there was also the principle of we must protect the truly needy, recognizing that there are some people who don't have enough skin to be in the game. So that was there as a matter of principle. Another thing that was there as a matter of principle that I think is very important and goes to something that Doug talked about is there was a commitment to not cut public investments, and a proposal to have a special committee that would look at that. I would go even further and say we need a pot of money that is dedicated to public investments. I'm talking about education, research, infrastructure, those kinds of things. That pot of money should be given to an independent agency, much like the Fed, that can then choose the kinds of investments around the country that have the greatest hope of achieving the vision that Doug laid out about growth and opportunity. I think that another principle was let's not do any harm to this very fragile recovery. It wasn't the commission's mandate to say anything about how to get out of the recession. But the other commission, the Rivlin-Domenici Commission, has put forward or did put forward the idea of a payroll tax holiday, and now we have a so-called tax deal, which has some terribly ugly elements as far as I'm concerned, but which, as David Leonhardt from the New York Times pointed out, is a backdoor stimulus plan that's even bigger than the first stimulus plan that has been so broadly criticized by those on the right. Specifically, the plan, the Bowles-Simpson plan, does contain some very draconian spending cuts, especially in the shorter term. I can't imagine them happening, and if they did, I would fear that they would really hurt low-income families. It does include radical tax reform, which I think has helped to break open this stalemate here in Washington in a really significant way. As Rudy says, the concrete is at least cracking, if not crumbling, on that front. And I'll be very surprised if we don't have tax reform over the next year or two, and we can only hope it looks like the vision that the commission presented to the country, because these so-called tax subsidies, commission calls them tax earmarks, which I think is a great label, because they are over $1 trillion a year, unlike the normal earmarks, which are only about $16 billion a year. So $16 billion versus $1 trillion, it's a huge difference. And they are like earmarks. They're not only large, they're very unfair, they're very regressive, and they're very inefficient. They really interfere with what Doug said about economic growth and opportunity. So that was a wonderful part of this report and this conversation. I thought the reforms to Social Security were very reasonable. They phase in enormously slowly. How can anybody worry about beginning to have a change in the retirement age 40 years from now? Benefits for the low income were actually increased, and also for the old, as has already been pointed out, and there is a hardship exemption for those in manual jobs. I hear a lot of people on the left complaining about the Social Security piece and putting out data that says that the Social Security population or beneficiaries are very badly off. And it's true that the typical Social Security recipient doesn't have much income and doesn't get a lot of benefits. But if you look at the entire distribution, which I have done, of Social Security recipients, it includes people like me. And I will get more than $1 million from the federal government during my retirement years. And do I need that? Well, you decide. You know, do I like it? You betcha. That's what I'd say if I was Sarah Palin. But I don't think I need it. And just to give you one statistic there, 20% in 2008, which is the last data we have, and it'll be much higher in the future, but 20% of elderly households in 2008 had incomes above $75,000 a year. And so this whole notion that they can't be asked to sacrifice even in a small way, and assuming that any change or reform of the Social Security system is carefully tailored to protect the more vulnerable, it seems to me ridiculous. Nobody worries about the single mom who is getting child care assistance so she can work and whose child care assistance in the state of California, whose budget problems are just a harbinger of what we're going to see at the federal level, is being denied her child care assistance and her ability to work, and nobody is saying, oh my gosh, you know, she should be ahead of the in the queue of that elderly person with an income above $75,000 a year. So I do think that we are still having a debate about all of that. Healthcare, I think there was a kind of magic asterisk. I agree with Dean on that point. And I think that that's because nobody knows the solution yet. But I would agree with both Dean and Doug, I think, that the existing health care reform law that we just worked so hard to enact, although it did some good things, it does not have costs under control sufficiently yet. So we need to be talking about more radical reforms there or taking a second bite out of the apple. And I think the Domenici-Rivlin group did take a bite out of that apple, which is quite controversial. They're talking about premium support or putting health care on a budget, and we can come back to that debate. Okay, I'm out of time. Three quick points of what the agenda should be going forward. First, take the second bite out of the health care apple. Second, figure out a way to fence off programs for the truly needy and programs that invest in the future. And third, think about an independent agency that can make those investments in the future in a sensible way. Thank you.
Thank you. So we have definitely already cleared up one burning question I've had for a long time, and that is that Bell Sawhill is not Sarah Palin. Let's stick with health care for a minute. Everyone agrees it's the biggest, Bellboy says it's the big enchilada. What are we going to do about health care? Dean?
Well, there's obviously a lot of things we could do. I think, first off, just a key point, I think the point is that we not focus on shifting costs. I mean, we set up Medicare and Medicaid because seniors couldn't afford health care, low-income people couldn't afford health care. It doesn't make sense to say, okay, now we're going to cut the public side of it. So, again, seniors won't be able to afford health care and low-income people won't be able to afford health care. Our costs, we currently spend more than twice as much per person as what they do in the average other wealthy countries, and it's projected to rise three and four times as much. Where do you start? Well, prescription drugs is one of my favorites. We're projected to spend $450 billion a year on prescription drugs by the end of the decade. If those were in patent protected, we'd probably spend about a tenth as much. We could devise more efficient ways to finance prescription drug research. A number of people, including Joe Stiglitz, have recommended that we have a prize fund, that we have public funding, where we basically buy up patents. I think we already spend $30 billion a year on financing biomedical research through NIH, so that shouldn't be an alien concept. Another idea that, you know, I originally came up with this as a joke, but I think it's actually, if we can't fix our healthcare system, why don't we give people vouchers, Medicare vouchers, to allow them to buy into the healthcare systems in Germany and Canada, split the savings. You know, they're retired. A lot of people have friends, family members. They might be very happy to go there and put $10,000 a year in their pocket on top of that. I mean, if we can't figure out, we're too dumb to figure out how to do it ourselves. I mean, dumb, powerful interest groups might prevent it. Let people opt out. What's wrong with giving people a choice, as my friends on the right like to say?
Other comments about health care, Doug?
Well, I mean, obviously there's no single magic bullet. This is a topic that's been studied and debated greatly, but from where I sit, it's, you know, the recently passed law makes enormous mistakes in that it sets up two large new entitlement programs that will grow at 8% a year as far as the eye can see. That is much faster than this economy will grow. It's much faster than revenue will grow in any circumstance. And this is at a time when we have demonstrable fiscal threats. So that strikes me as an important step in the wrong direction. And we ought to just be honest about that and take an approach that doesn't wildly throw money at that problem, but instead does the parts of the bill that had more bipartisan support, the delivery system reforms, and the hopes on cost control, feature those, beef them up, and be a little more realistic on the budgetary front.
So you would repeal all or part of it?
Oh, there's much of it with which I have deep substantive disagreement and would be happy to see go away.
Other comments?
Well, I don't see.
Go ahead, Rudy. Go ahead.
I don't see how we'll ever get health costs under control without some form of strict budget controls. We need a budget like they have in Britain and Canada. That implies rationing of some sort, and that's extremely controversial. The question is, what sort? Do you turn the job over to the medical profession, as they do in Canada and Britain pretty much? Or do you have some sort of premium support system? Or are you very strict in what you call effective medicine versus ineffective medicine? Which I think basically is not a scientific, but rather a political kind of judgment. I guess my bias is that in this country, probably the only acceptable means is some sort of premium support. That's going to be very complicated. It'll cause inequities here and there. But frankly, I don't see any other way of doing it. And if it works, it will make the system more efficient.
If I could just comment quickly on the use of the term
ration. Hold it. Bruce.
Let me just say a little bit about what we did or what we proposed to do. Our commission started just as the health reform debate was ending, so it was a wonderful time to be doing bipartisan work. The most interesting thing was that both sides seemed equally exhausted by the debate. So occasionally the co-chairs would say, everything is on the table, even the recently passed health care reform bill, and Republicans and Democrats alike would run screaming from the room saying, please don't make us go through this again. But over the course of numerous discussions with both sides, we did find some things that are still possible without, we were unable to find consensus on what to do about the underlying health bill itself. But there are a number of steps that we could take that I think both sides would agree would be a step in the right direction. First is there are a lot of budget gimmicks associated with health care, and every year Congress does the doc fix, the physician payment scheme, and refuses to pay for it. That's about $300 billion over the course of 10 years that, if we're holding ourselves on a host of other programs to the principle that we ought to pay for what we do, then we ought to do the same for doctors. What we said was we should propose a series of ways to pay for that included paying doctors somewhat less, asking for some changes in the in medical malpractice that would mean doctors that lawyers would take less, and finding some more ways to do cost sharing that would give individuals some skin in the game. We proposed repealing or replacing the CLASS Act, which is this long-term care insurance program that was part of health reform that raises money in the short term and is woefully underfunded in the long haul. We did not propose a single long-term answer because we couldn't get consensus on it. We did agree with Rudy that we ought to put ourselves on a long-term budget and force ourselves to have that debate. We did propose one one idea that seemed to have caused equal anxiety for both sides, which is I agree with Bell and Rudy that we're going to have to face up to the question of whether to do premium support. No one knows whether that will actually work for the Medicare population or not. We proposed a demonstration of premium support with the Federal Employee Benefits Plan, which is pretty close to premium support as it is. Our view was that if you're going to do a demonstration like that, don't experiment with old people. The federal health population, much healthier and younger, and we can see whether an idea like a fixed payment scheme actually works before we apply it to something as fundamental to the social safety net as Medicare.
Dee.
Just quickly, and
I haven't had a chance to come on this question.
I'm sorry.
Think he already
no,
has, right?
Go, okay, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
You didn't have your hand up. I know.
Fairness.
Except for colleagues.
I just want to say that I think it's really important to remember that what we really should care about is people's health and not just the amount of health care they get. And there are good studies, as most of you probably know, that show that there's an enormous amount of healthcare spending that does not translate into better health. Other countries do it much better and much more cheaply than we do. They do put their systems on a budget. And then I think the way you try to avoid the kind of cost shifting that Dean and others worry about is to change the payment system to one that only pays for treatments and other activities in the system that have been demonstrated to improve people's health. Now, is that easy to do? Absolutely not. It's extraordinarily difficult. But we shouldn't let the perfect be the enemy of the good here. We desperately, I think, need to move in the direction of payment reform that rewards stuff that helps people's health. And if we did that in the public systems, because the private healthcare system usually adopts the payment systems that are that exist in the public sector, it could make a huge difference over time.
Dean.
Just very quick, I was just going to say with Rudy's comment, I don't think we should really use the term rationing because we're not strictly speaking talking about rationing. We're saying some things the government will pay for, others it won't. If I have money and want to go out and buy it, I would be able to do that. I don't think anyone envisions a plan where people be prohibited from buying health care procedures that they choose to pay for out of their own pocket.
And I want to correct the record and just acknowledge that the final report did repeal the Class Act, and I think that's a very important step. I mean, it's literally a Ponzi scheme and something we can't afford.
And the demonstration program is good, too.
Let's not pass this Class Act, because there could be people in the audience that don't know about this. This is the classic example of how lousy Congress is and the kind of junk they do that winds up really being a huge burden for the future.
Well, you should talk about it because you like it more than I do.
Go ahead.
Class Act is a long-term care insurance program structured as follows. Make premium payments, which are really payroll tax contributions, for 5 years, at which point you qualify for benefits in the future. The 5 years during which the premiums are collected are the 5 years that count in the 10-year budget window, so that you get $70 billion up front from Class Act contributions. None of the spending that is to follow counts toward the budget computations on the health care bill. So it's a budget gimmick of the most fundamental sort. Second issue you have is that the premiums are supposed to be actuarially fair, but it is the historic record of any insurance-style program in the federal government, whether it's deposit insurance or flood insurance or pension benefit, that in the end we don't charge actuarially fair premiums. We say, geez, that benefit's not very good, and we juice up the benefit, premium stays low, pretty soon we've got an enormous budget mismatch, and it's going to be structured just like Social Security. So we'll find out about this problem later, and oh my God, have to do something unfair, like scale it back. So it's a recipe for disaster in almost every dimension, and probably will be have bad adverse selection problems.
And they did it because they wanted the money to offset costs in a bill that they were passing. I will say I was in worked in the House for 14 years, worked close to the Budget Committee on many occasions, and I can remember the first few times that I heard about this kind of gimmick and put money into the next year and so forth, I said, they can't do that. They do it all the time. I don't understand why our system permits this. We'd be a lot better off if we really had budget rules and followed them. All right. Everybody has brought up here the issue of taxes, and we're all, you know, wondering about what's going to happen with taxes. I recently had a chance to hear a debate between Paul Ryan and David Brooks. And David Brooks looked at Paul Ryan near the end of the debate, and he said, you're going to blow a big opportunity here. We got a chance to really do something on the deficit. And what the President's Commission put on the table is approximately 60% spending cuts and 40% tax increases, and you won't take it. If it were 70-30, you wouldn't take it. If it were 80-20, if it were 90-10, you wouldn't take it. Ryan did not say he would take 90-10. My question to the panel is, are Republicans ready for serious, whatever, in whatever way, that there will be more revenues than we currently get as a contribution toward reducing the deficit? Rudy.
Well, I'd put the point another way.
I thought you might.
A necessary condition for them even considering it is to do it with lower marginal tax rates. And the only way you can do that is with the kind of fundamental tax reform that's appeared in a lot of these committee recommendations. Whether they would do it even then, I can't say for sure. But as I said in the beginning, I think the concrete is cracking. After all, Senator Colburn did vote for a plan that has a fairly significant...
And so did Crapo.
So did Crapo, yes. So they voted for plans that had a fairly significant tax increases. And I haven't looked to see if they signed Grover Norquist's pledge at the same time, but that would be an interesting bit of research.
Other comments?
So, a couple of random comments. Random comment number one is not all Republicans are ready for that. I mean, that's a fact, I think.
What?
Not all Republicans are ready for tax increases. That's a fact. There's some are going to just say no, and that'll be it. The second is, I think Rudy's point about tax reform is right, that they'll do more revenue if they get better tax policy out of it. And the third is, whatever the numbers are, 90-10, 80-20, it is a necessary political precondition that the 80 or 90 or 70 or whatever the number is be real. Many Republicans are thoroughly convinced that the game is going to be promise 80-20, take the 20 and never do the 80. And so the spending side is paramount. And it's paramount as a matter of the numbers. It's going to be paramount as a matter of the politics. And the economics are simple. If you spend the money, you have to pay for it one way or another. So we got to take care of the spending problem. And that I think, is going to be the litmus test, whether there's a serious effort on spending, and that would give you the route to tax reform. And as I said, we had this conversation a couple days ago. You do have to worry a lot, I think, about how you do the sequencing of these things, both from a political point of view, but also a policy point of view. Because, for example, the top tax expenditure that you want to target is the exclusion from tax of employer-sponsored health insurance. If you were to repeal that or significantly dial it back, many, 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 perhaps all employees would end up in the publicly funded exchanges under the new healthcare law, and the budget would explode. And so you got to think about both sides of this at the same time.
Dean, were you itching to say something here?
Yeah, well, a couple things. First off, just the explosion of spending. Again, if we look at the numbers, if you go back to 1980 and you look at the projections of the president's budget for 2020, non-interest spending increases by a grand total of 1.3 percentage points of GDP. That doesn't look like an explosion to me. I might have different eyes, but that doesn't look like an explosion. In terms of, do we get anything? I think obviously the formula is get rid of a lot of the loopholes for somewhat lower rates. And again, does that end up being a money raiser? I think for the Democrats it has to be at least somewhat, or you're not going to get that. The last point I just make, it's amazing to me that there seems to be no discussion at all in this town of some sort of financial speculation tax, because we are in this, at least in part. I know the Republicans in the Financial Crisis Commission excluded this possibility, but we're in the Great Recession, at least in part, because of Wall Street excesses. There's a lot of money there. There's a lot of rents there. Even the International Monetary Fund, not an organization known to be hostile to bankers, has come out for having heavier taxes on the financial sector. You could, by my calculations, raise as much as $150 billion a year. England raises the equivalent of $40 billion a year just taxing stock trades, doing nothing with derivatives, credit default swaps, et cetera. It's amazing to me that somehow that never gets discussed when we're pressing deficit reduction. It seems an obvious place to go. To my mind, almost free money.
Yeah.
Tiny correction to the record. Regardless of what Dean may believe, the Financial Crisis Commission has not issued any final reports from either Democrats, Republicans, or the independents on the commission. That will happen in January, at which point the conclusions will be public.
Can I just
Yeah, go ahead. Let's make these very brief because I want to get to audience. Go ahead.
Thanks. On the question of Republicans and taxes, first off, I think it's important to recognize that both Democrats and the jury is still out on both on whether both Democrats and Republicans will cut spending as well. It's not just a question of whether Republicans will belly up to the buzzsaw on taxes. I would say three things about what Republicans have three conditions, all of which are perfectly reasonable on this point. First, as Doug said, if we're going to bring in more revenues, we have to cut spending, and we have to make sure that the spending cuts actually materialize, because that often hasn't happened in the past. Tax increases haven't happened much in the past either in recent years. But in any event, I think that's a perfectly fair point. I think they raised the point that this can't be a slippery slope. This can't be, well, let's raise taxes now and then let's raise taxes later. Big turning point in our discussions was when we decided to cap revenues at 21% of GDP, which is controversial on the Democratic side of the aisle, but is actually an important condition to make sure that you're not just on a slippery slope. And when we ruled out doing a VAT, because I think there are good arguments for consumption taxes, but the Republicans' counterargument was, well, you can't have the current tax system plus a consumption tax on top of that. And then I think the third point is this is all about tax reform. We will never raise revenues in the absence of fixing the system we have. For Tom Coburn and Mike Crapo, actually the tax reform elements of the president's plan are the most compelling part of it at all. Why? They view this as Ronald Reagan on steroids. That if you believe in that cutting tax rates will generate economic growth, then you should put your money where your mouth is. And that the that broadening the base, lowering the rates, will make the economy larger, stronger, bring in more revenues, and that with those additional revenues, you could bring rates down more, you could reduce the deficit more. But I think it is as we've seen in the past couple of weeks, there's never been a better argument for tax reform than what we've seen in the past couple of weeks, where both sides are debating the future of the Bush tax cuts, which, frankly, neither side cares that much about anymore. Why should we have a debate about whether the top rate should be 35 or 39 when we could broaden the base and get corporate and individual rates down into the 20s and have a stronger, more efficient economy in the bargain?
You didn't let me speak on this. May I just please?
Yes.
Feel so strongly about
it. Everybody out there have a lunch? Go ahead.
Well, everybody's spoken but me, Ron. I think this is part of a larger political dynamic, and I just want to put that on the table because, you know, I agree with what Bruce is saying, and, you know, we have some momentum around tax reform now, but the larger political dynamic here is that there are a lot of us who would like to see more bipartisanship, but you can't have unilateral bipartisanship. You can't have the president saying, I'll do all of the compromising, or the Democrats in Congress saying, we'll do all the compromising, because Republicans are in concrete, as you said in telling the story about Brooks and Ryan, on taxes. Now, as Doug points out, you know, maybe they aren't all in total concrete, and as Bruce says, maybe through tax reform they'll go along with something. And as he also says, and as Stuart always points out to me, if they could be assured that any revenue increases were temporary or were not going to lead to increases in spending, but were going to be dedicated to deficit reduction, there might be the makings of an agreement. But the fact is that the 70-30 spending tax split in Bowles-Simpson is much more tilted towards spending than Domenici Rivlin, who were able to accomplish quite a lot with much closer to 50-50. And so I think this is a political issue, not a policy issue.
Can I say one more thing? Which is the fundamental question is, are both sides ready to govern? And one of the reasons that I give Tom Coburn and Mike Crapo so much credit is that there was a lot in this package that they didn't like, and they've had to stand up to Grover Norquist and a lot of other interests in their party. But they said, look, this problem, we can't afford to wait for another election. We can't afford to take the country off the cliff to wait until we get everything that we want. We have to do what Ronald Reagan did from time to time. We have to do great leaders always do, which is find a principled compromise that does the right thing for the country. And without both revenues and spending cuts, you can't get a bipartisan agreement.
All right, audience, we have 30 seconds for questions from the audience. Ask brief, succinct questions, please. Start right back there in the middle on your right. Your right.
Hi, I'm Becky Thies with the Economic Policy Institute. My question is for Dean Baker. We've heard a lot about sort of the crisis that's coming, and I'm wondering if you can speak to why we may end up or may not end up looking like Greece or Ireland.
Well, thanks for your question. First, you know, you said the crisis is coming. It just reminds me we should be thinking we are in a crisis now, because we are. I mean, 25 million people unemployed, underemployed, or giving up work altogether. If we had been sitting here again 3 years ago and I said, you know, the world was going to look like this, people would think I was nuts. You know, this is a pretty bad situation. And again, that's one of my concerns about the deficit focus, that it seems to be at the expense of the current crisis. But in terms of the Greece, Portugal, Ireland analogy, it's a very simple point. We have our own currency. There's other differences. We're a large, diversified economy. The idea that, you know, investors are just going to run. I like to play games with people. I go, work that through. Okay, so we're going to have China, which is screaming at us they can't raise the value of their currency by 20%. They're going to let the dollar fall by 50% against the yuan. Does that make sense? Because we are such a large economy with still a good industrial base, still considerable export capacity, we export over $1.5 trillion a year, we don't have to worry in the same way that a Greece or Ireland does. But the last point is, because we make our own currency, it can never take exactly the same form. And that is an important point. I mean, we might have a horror story, but it's not one of insolvency. At the end of the day, we can buy our own debt. That can raise an issue of inflation. But it's not going to raise the issue of the credit markets telling us X, Y, and Z, and we're going to have, you know, the IMF and China, whatever bad boys we envision, coming there and dictating to us. I mean, we may opt to do that. We may tell the Fed, no, don't ever buy our debt. We'd rather be dictated to. But that would be a policy choice. We have the option to have the Fed buy our own currency, which creates perhaps an inflation problem, which we'd have to take seriously. But it's not the horror story that we see with Greece or Ireland.
Next question. Over here. Get the mic first, please.
Don Mathis, Community Action. At his speech at EPI the other day, Larry Summers said his recommendation to the president would be a massive investment in infrastructure, which would put people back to work. Do any of the plans we've been discussing permit such a massive investment in infrastructure?
Good question.
Well, it depends what you call massive. The president's commission has something called a cut and invest committee that is expressly for that purpose.
I think that would put huge numbers. I mean, I don't think it was intended that way, in fairness. I mean, I don't think the intention was that would be short-term stimulus. I may be misrepresenting
it. No.
Next question. In the back, turn around on your – okay, there you go. Thank you.
For those – Jim Klumpner, I'm a visiting lecturer at a couple of universities. For those of you who think most of the heavy lifting has to be done on the spending side – Would you please tell us about specific spending cuts totaling hundreds of billions of dollars?
I'll take that one.
We get lots of general statements about spending this, spending that.
We got the question. Let's get the answer.
Go to our website, www.fiscalcommission.gov. We have we proposed an illustrative list of $200 billion a year in spending cuts, evenly divided, defense and non-defense. It's a great list. No one agrees with everything on it, that was one of our first principles. Erskine Bowles said repeatedly he hates it when politicians go on TV and say they're going to cut spending but won't say what they're going to cut. Take a look. We've got lots of tough medicine there.
Any other additions?
I think that's the right answer. And I want to echo a point that was made earlier, which is that when we talk a lot about Republicans and tax increases, both parties have spent a lot of money and shown an unwillingness to cut. So I think the real litmus test is when we see that change.
One last question from the audience right here.
I think it's easy to say that the public understands the severity of the crisis because it's often ranked as the second or third most important problem that we have a rising deficit. And it's easy to say that Washington is dysfunctional because it doesn't get the message. But actually, I think that if you're a Democrat with a small d, you'd have to say that the politicians in Washington reflect the views of the public pretty well. In the wake of these commission reports, I read a Bloomberg poll result. They oppose doing almost everything. The only thing that they favor is raising taxes on people who have high wages and maybe raising income taxes on people who have high incomes. But they basically oppose virtually everything that these commissions recommended. So I don't quite see, and please help me understand, why is it that Washington is dysfunctional because it doesn't get the message and the public has the view that we should do something about this when, in fact, they oppose almost everything that could be done about it.
Doug.
So I want to, first of all, agree with the basic premise, which is that politicians are responsive to what their constituents reward them with. And if they, historically have been rewarded by increasing the deficit, that's what got them reelected, that's exactly the correct observation. What's different now, and we've done some polling at the American Action Forum, we did it particularly in House districts that were close races, what policy issues move votes, and in ways that were historically unprecedented, concerns over spending and debt moved votes. People usually just talk about it, but they don't vote it. So that's a little glimmer, step number one, on whether people will now reward politicians for doing something differently than it did in the past, which is closing the deficit will get you reelected, not widening it. And so I do think people are at displaying different behavior on the ground than they have in the past. And the politics of this have to change because we know we can't continue down the path we're on. And at some point, something has to give. Historic politics versus our financial future. And they're on a collision course. And I think we've seen some evidence the politics are starting to change. And I will be very interested to see if it sticks.
You know,
Can I just add? I mean, I think the real crying need here is leadership. To sell painful policies. And we've seen it done in a great variety of countries. Now, admittedly, the leadership doesn't usually appear until there is some sort of crisis. But we have seen Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Sweden all deal with
UK.
Crises.
Well, aren't you going to add UK?
Yeah. Deal with crises and the policy reaction involved not printing money, thank God, but actually raising taxes and cutting spending in a fairly rational way.
And I think it's important to just amend the way it matters a lot how you ask this question. If you ask the question, do you want to cut Social Security, the answer is going to be no. If you ask the question, do you believe it's important to control the growth of Social Security as part of avoiding and then characterize the alternative correctly, your children suffering a decline in the standard of living relative to where you are, any way you place it as a realistic choice, they are much more favorable toward getting our fiscal house in order.
Dean?
I think people do support cuts in defense spending manifest in the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, which are very unpopular. But in terms of the overall picture, I think people see an economy where the Wall Street people, to a large extent, got us here, are doing better than ever. And the idea that they're going to sacrifice in that context, I don't think is very realistic, or at least that they'll be happy about sacrificing in that context.
So please join me in thanking the panel. And now the second panel can come. And Bill Shambro, where are you? I hope you do a better job on controlling the panelists than your predecessor.